The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, Space Show listeners. Welcome to our Friday morning program. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in, and we appreciate that, especially those of you on the East Coast who are getting ready for, I guess, what may be a pretty large snowstorm. We don't get that in the San Francisco Bay Area, so in a way I miss it, but in a way I'm really happy that it's going to be about 65 degrees here today and pretty sunny. Anyway, on to our program, because this is really an important program for those of you who believe in a future for space. I'll tell you more about that in just a minute. It's also a program that really seeks your participation and your spreading the word about what we're going to talk about with Dr. Bainbridge today. So first the announcements, and then I'll explain all of that. So if you would like to call us today and talk to our guest, Dr. William Bainbridge, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. There are no call screeners. Please let the phone ring, and I'll answer it as soon as possible and bring you up on the air. And again, we're asking everybody who calls to please make sure you disengage call forwarding if you happen to have it, or call waiting. And also, make sure you have a good quality phone line, because calls where we can't understand the caller, well, they just don't work. And we appreciate your paying attention to those things. And again, be patient. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also email us, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then please do remember we're copyrighted and trademarked, but you do have permission to download our shows and to pass them around and share them. A 90-minute program is about 40 megabytes, and we use transferbigfiles.com to send a file that big to different people when we need to send them. I know there are lots of other services that do this, including free services like transferbigfiles.com. And if you have any questions about that, I'm happy to respond to you. Please remember not to edit the shows, not to do anything commercial. Written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And no edits or clips for private YouTube channels or even your own personal or business website. And if you do have a specific use in mind for a spaceship program, please let us know, and let's see if we can work something out. And we appreciate your honoring our very few and simple requests. Remember also that we podcast through gigadial.net. You'll find our RSS URL for subscribing to our podcast on our website and in both of our newsletters. If you have any issues or problems with our podcast, please do email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. You can find us in iTunes, Microsoft Zoom, and a host of other places. And again, thank you for letting us know if you have suggestions for more places for our podcast, or if you have any questions about how best to access our podcast, even if you're using a smartphone or one of the new tablets like the iPad or something of that nature. Our website is thespaceshow.com. You'll find our detailed, comprehensive newsletter there in the middle of the page. You can't miss it. That is uploaded Sunday evening, and it has all of the details of our week's programming, our guest bios, and it's the only place we have a future events section. And do check us there from time to time, because often we do have to modify our weekly schedule, and you will see it posted first on the website newsletter. You will also find a pop-up window there, or if you just want to subscribe to our very short Monday morning email newsletter. Send your request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do going back to 2001 is archived on our site. We're approaching 2,000 programs, and you can easily listen off of our site or easily download the programs. Again, if you need help in doing that, send me a note at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our store is there. You'll see it up near the top, Space Show Gear. Probably the most important button is our Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and we exist because many of you do generously support us, and we thank you for that support. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you're entitled to a tax deduction. And if you're a California taxpayer, you also get a California state deduction, as we are a public benefit corporation in California. And that brings me to telling you a little bit about our show today and our guests. So I'm really honored and very happy to bring to you Dr. William Bainbridge, who is the author or co-author of 21 social scientific books and over 200 articles or books and chapters. He has his PhD from Harvard with a dissertation about the social history of space exploration published as The Space Flight Revolution. The starting point of his field research for that project was watching the last launch to the moon on the way to the moon from Florida in December of 1972. In 1986, he was over at JPL assessing the possibility of a research project about JPL, and that is when Challenger exploded. The shock of that accident motivated him to carry out a complex multi-phase questionnaire project to chart the multiple values and space exploration may serve humanity, and he published this in a book called Goals in Space. He has a new project, and you can read about this on the web and on our blog. The Space Futures Project is a new project which is combining insights from a conventional random sampled public opinion poll with questions about space exploration and our attitudes. And then he's going to evaluate this and publish it. And we're going to talk about his surveys. We're going to talk about why they are important, especially this one, what he is looking for from people who are pretty well informed in the space community, and that includes the listeners to this program. He's interested in our perspectives. And on the Space Show blog is all of the information to access both the Droid app, which is a little bit different from taking the survey as a Word document. There is a short form of the survey, 200 questions, and then there's a URL that takes you to the full Word document, which has 300 questions on it. And we're going to talk about these surveys and what Dr. Bainbridge is looking for and why this information is so valuable and why you should help spread the word for people to take this survey, take it with you to conferences, and let people who really understand and know about space express their perspectives on how they see space over the next 50 years. Dr. Bainbridge, welcome to the Space Show. This is indeed an honor to talk to you, sir. How are you this morning?
Well, I'm just fine, and the honor is all mine. I really appreciate being here and very much respect what you've done.
Thank you. So tell us a little bit about your survey, you know, why you're doing it, what you hope to get from it, and a little bit about the logistics, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. There are at least two kinds of major survey methods, and what people are mostly familiar with is random sample public opinion polls. Those are great. I've been involved with a number of them. I have a book chapter coming out in a NASA book where I analyze literally dozens of them. But they tend to ask just one or two questions about space exploration in a rather vague way that anybody can answer. And what I'm trying to do with the current project is get the insights from people who care, who've informed themselves about space exploration, and who may, among them, across the group, have a variety of different perspectives on what's possible, what's desirable, what's interesting, and so on. taking, I hate to use the word psychology, but the psychologists tend to create questionnaires where the goal is not a random sample, but a rich questionnaire with a lot of somewhat similar items that allows them to use statistical techniques not to predict what the voter would do, but to understand how knowledgeable people put the ideas together in their minds. And so that's what this part of the project is about. I'm also, the particular questionnaire we're focusing on has 100 predictions that came from an online open-ended questionnaire and from a NASA report about what might be achieved in the next 50 years in space. And people rate these ideas twice. Once in terms of how likely each of them is, and then in terms of how good it would be if it were achieved. Now, in future, we may have other questionnaires with other focus. And so I'm really interested in hearing open-ended, free-form ideas from your community of listeners, because that may affect the next thing we do after this one. But for now, I really beg your listeners to at least complete the short form of the questionnaire so their ideas and their conceptualization will be part of this project.
Now, is this an official NSF policy, program, or is this a project on your own?
I am, of course, a government employee at the National Science Foundation, but this is a totally independent research project. My agency and other science agencies want their people to be doing research, continuing to do research. I've several times published with NASA, but it was never an official NASA job. I was doing it as part of my ordinary research, as a faculty member at a university might do. So anything I say today, just as your disclaimer at the beginning of the program gave, is my personal view or my attempt to understand the views of the people who call or write emails in, rather than anything remotely like an official perspective. And I'm not on government duty at this exact point in the day.
The listeners, the URLs where this information are located are, as I said, on the blog already, and they will be in the archive write-up. They're a little bit long to read out over the air, so I would suggest you all go to the Space Show blog, and you can find the location for downloading the Droid app if you happen to work with the Droid operating system on your smartphone or tablet. And then you can find the longer version, which is on a URL, or the shorter version, which is 200 questions. You'll see that listed there as well. So, and just for housekeeping purposes and for those listeners who work off of the iPhone platform, are you planning to make this available in that format, or they should do the Word document forms?
It won't be available soon, if at all. You see, another dimension of this is research on how to do questionnaires in the changing environment. You know that standard methods aren't working as well as they did years ago. Random digital dialing telephone questionnaires are not working now that people have mobile devices and all kinds of other things. And by doing an Android app, and there are actually two of them, one Space Futures, one on Opinions, which is really replicating the 1986 study. So that's why we're focusing on the future one here. These are free Android apps that can be downloaded. We did an Android app summer before last that was on a very general topic that anyone might be interested in. It was basically one of the standard personality tests in a somewhat more elaborate format. And we found that it worked extremely well and got a large number of respondents. But the app market has changed in 18 months. And a specialized topic such as attitudes toward space exploration may not spread throughout the online community in the same way. So I'm trying to draw conclusions from this, not only about the topic, which I care deeply about, but also about the methodology that we should be using, or the range of methodologies in the coming years, to understand the thinking that people across the world and the nation have.
So the Apple platform users go in and use either the 300 questionnaire URL or the short form,
right,
which is on the blog. And again, I'll put in the summary. Now, I did the 300 question version, and I did it in 100 question blocks. So once I understood your rating system, which is 8 is most likely or most beneficial, and 1 would be, you know, the opposite of that, it actually goes very, very quickly. So, listeners, I think you'll find it pretty interesting and even at times fun to fill out the items on your computer, and then you email the forms back to Dr. Bainbridge. So you're looking for, first of all, in terms of logistics, you're not asking, or at least I didn't see any demographic questions like our age or what kind of position we have in the space community or what our education is, or, you know, do we work for industry or do we work for a nonprofit, you know, typical questions like that. So you're not breaking this down demographically?
That's a complex question. The Android version of the app has optional age and gender questions. Again, we're the one we did 18 months ago actually got the person's location. So we're experimenting with the appropriate methodology in that area of demographics. But what this is focusing on is the range of viewpoints people have, particularly how they cluster the different ideas together in their mind. And maybe after we find the core set of clusters, then we might do another survey that went into the demographics. Of course, demographics is something where traditional random sample surveys do the best job.
So when you talk about a core set of clusters, give us an example of what a cluster would be. For example, I noticed there were quite a few questions about our ability to go to Mars, have a Mars settlement, to start terraforming Mars. So is Mars a cluster, like the general topic of Mars a cluster?
Well, we'll find out. There are also a bunch of items about the moon, some of which came from a NASA report just a few years ago about what we might do there. Do people link things in terms of an activity? Setting up a base on the moon correlates with setting up a base on Mars. Or, as you suggested, do the locations divided in their mind? Now, as the links that you gave people, at least one of them, could take them to an online copy of my now somewhat old book, Goals in Space, where anybody can look at how we did this a quarter century ago. And in that case, industrial and economic applications fitted together. Highly idealistic things fitted together, extraterrestrial colonization and exploitation of resources fitted together, defense things fitted together. But that's what I'm looking to learn. And indeed, if we get a significant number of respondents, I can divide it up and look at how people with somewhat different values conceptualize it. So the methodology is, yes, I start out trying to get a range of items, and that do really relate plausibly to the next 50 years, at least someone said they might. But what I want to learn is how you put them together in your own minds.
So for the listeners, there really isn't, you know, as we say with a lot of ideas, there isn't anything that's really wacky or crazy, like we're able to settle Mars right now today. versus people who say it's really way off in the future. There's no judgment or anything like that through your survey. It's totally seeking the person's perception on these particular questions and issues. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I did try to include a range on that, not because I know what's achievable or what our society is likely to invest in. There will be some items that any given respondent thinks are quite implausible, and that's why I'm asking the respondent, how likely is it we'll achieve this in 50 years? Some of them will seem very unlikely, but I'm not making a judgment. I'll be interested to see how the respondents do that, and I'm also asking them to judge if it were possible to achieve each one, how bad or good would it be? And there are, frankly, a few items in the list that are very pessimistic at the opposite extreme. And that'll allow me to see the full range of optimism versus pessimism that your listeners and other respondents may have.
You have an initial email question coming in from Jeremy in San Diego, California. And he says, Dr. Bainbridge, I've been looking at the questions since the show started. I went to David's blog, and that's how I found them. I'm wondering if this information is shared with people who actually have the charge of making policy, for example, congressional staffers, and do they use this in a way, or can they use this in a way, as if their constituents were actually writing them letters or calling them or visiting them to know what people think or want about space? Does it have that type of potential?
It certainly does. Indeed, one of the areas where there is a lot of information science research going on right now is sometimes called digital government. This is really evolving. Some of the science agencies have funded a great diversity of things like this. And, of course, there is an awareness that while you want the consent of the governed, you want every citizen and voter to have that voice heard, that people will differ in terms of how much they care or are knowledgeable about specific areas. Now, in the past, as I say, I've published with NASA. I've published in a range of different places. The aim here is to get a fairly quick summary online quickly that could be linked to many blogs, such as the one relating to this program. As to which scientific or other publishers would give it their stamp of approval, well, I have a good history in the past. One of the publishers I'm often worked with is considering a series on space futures and a book that would have a chapter based on this study by me is under consideration. Those things have always worked out in the past. So we can't tell the Congress or staffers or people in the relevant agencies, they need to pay attention. But the information will be made available to them, of course, anonymously. That's one reason for not having a lot of demographics in the questionnaire, the range of ideas they should be considering. And I'd be very open to future projects with them, as I've done in the past with NASA, to explore further ideas that come up in this project.
People who are outside the United States, are they welcome to participate in this as well?
They certainly are. And indeed, the online questionnaire, it was a big one, over 40,000 respondents, about 15,000, 20,000 of which. I had an open-ended question about the future in science and technology in general. And the space items here, largely but not exclusively, came from that. That was international. It was English language. A substantial number of the respondents were Canadian. Others were British. others were English speakers in other areas. While some of the reasons for having a space program are indeed national in terms of prestige, security, economy, and so on, this is not a nationalistic thing. It's open to perspectives from around the globe. Other planets, have you got any listeners up there?
Of course, I recall, you know, if my aging memory serves me correctly here, that you did have questions about U.S. space leadership, right?
In general, that people can respond to that in the way they wish. I'm also very open to working with folks in other countries. I was later involved with another online questionnaire that was done in French, German, and Italian. We have to recognize in my older book, Goals in Space, which actually surveyed Harvard students, did have more of a U.S. Focus. So I hope that people will respond from wherever they are, from whatever perspective they have.
This is from Carrie, C-A-R-R-I-E, in St. Louis. And Carrie says, I often listen to space show programs when I'm home from school and I'm home with the flu, so that's why I'm able to listen today. So are you interested in having middle school students respond to your survey? We certainly are not as professional or knowledgeable as probably your target audience, but do you want middle school or students, for that matter, responding?
Absolutely. I think you're self-selecting. It's free. Anybody who is interested enough to have an opinion and want to express it. I have to tell you that I remember I was, 7 years old when I saw my first eclipse of the moon. And I know very well how people well before your grade level may have a lot of thoughts about this. And I'm not defining who is an expert. It's if you have thoughts and ideas, I want to know about them.
I just want to be clear for people. So if a listener out there is involved in the entrepreneurial commercial space business and is ready to engage space solar power tomorrow or whatever their wish list or hope list is, that person's views are still being sought after and are probably more preferential than a general audience person that you might see Letterman or somebody else interviewing on the street who probably has very little knowledge about the space industry, correct? You're not interested in the specific focus that a person may have on space or whether it's near-term plausible or whether it's 100 years out, like, say, intergalactic travel or something like that?
I guess I trust people to decide for themselves whether they... I mean, first of all, they're not going to do it if they don't care. If they care, whatever the background, they'll have ideas, they'll have perspectives. So I just have to trust people. For example, I have to trust your entrepreneur not to submit 1,000 questionnaires all saying that their area is the best one. I have to trust people. I will obviously be looking for very unusual kinds of responses and may weigh them differently. There may be artists who don't have a technical background but throughout their lives have paid attention. Yes, the crucial thing is to include people who are more knowledgeable, but we also want diversity among people who care.
That is an important consideration, trusting people, because there really is no way to prevent someone from doing this 20 times and trying to skew the results. So people don't do that. I guess that would be the, you know, the plea. Just do it one time and then, you know, let your responses stand on their own for his analysis. Correct. You don't want multiple responses from people, right?
I certainly don't want them. On the other hand, when I used to teach for 20 years in universities, there was always that question about whether one person did the homework for several. So I'm familiar with different aspects of this challenge.
Having done the test and looked at it, I have to say it really was comprehensive. So let me ask you about a part of the technique that you were able to do. So again, I'm going to take Mars or the moon as an example. So you might ask about Mars settlement or needing to have a place to go for emergencies for Earth, which probably are logically Mars. And these questions are asked differently each time, and they're scattered throughout the survey. They are not grouped together.
Right.
So I'm assuming that is the desired methodology, to maybe reword the question to see if you can get a different perspective and to not group the questions together. So Mars is all throughout the survey, as is the moon. You even have a question about hybrid rocket power.
The overwhelming majority of the items were distilled from what thousands of people wrote into the open-ended web survey questionnaire. In a couple of cases, I may have rewritten an item two different ways, but basically that wasn't the approach. I'm perfectly happy to say how we do the analysis. There are a couple of ways. For example, I can take it as two separate blocks of 100 items. Such as how bad versus good would it be if we achieved this list of 100 things. Now, one thing I can do, the computer will calculate correlation coefficients, and I can use techniques like factor analysis, and forgive me for mentioning it, but I have published textbooks with software on how to do these things. And that would give you the dimensions in how people evaluated these 100 different ideas. And that statistical technique would group items together. And then, of course, I would read and maybe write about the items that were all part of one dimension. That's a dimension where some people like it, other people don't like it, so there's variation, but the items group together. So that's a very empirical way, as I said earlier. How I think they group isn't as important as how the people group them. Now, there's another way to do it, and that is to combine the two kinds of items, and you can do this for each individual respondent. You've already sent me your data, and I appreciate it. I've got it. I haven't analyzed it yet, just got it. I could identify which of the 100 items you really thought would be good, but you don't think will be achieved. That's sort of your utopian view or your long-term view. We'll do those a century later. I could see things, I could look at things that you think will be achieved, but aren't particularly good. So in other words, I can look at optimism versus pessimism within each respondent or across all of them, in terms of different areas. So while I use this with my mind switched fully on, the objective statistical techniques for analyzing the data allow the respondents' conceptualizations to shine through either approach.
Robert is in Seattle, Washington, and says, David, I'm at work, you know the drill, hence my email question. As somebody who is a space enthusiast, but I don't work in the community, but I do listen to your programs, and I do from time to time go to space conferences, I'm wondering what the benefit is to the space community for having done this survey and having the research put out there. Will this somehow benefit the space community, all segments of it, say new space or commercial space, or does it support existing NASA policy or something like that? What is the benefit for all of us taking the survey? How does it come back to us?
Complex set of questions. Seattle, Washington, well, that's actually where I was living when I took my various trips down to Jet Propulsion Laboratory. That is a great part of the country and a lot of high-tech stuff out there. First of all, because the majority of the items, except some where NASA had talked about, NASA had done a workshop where a number of scientists and similar professionals had identified a list of things that might be accomplished on the moon. So even the NASA report items aren't NASA's plan. They're from a categorization of potential activities on the moon. And the rest of it comes from a range of interested people. So this may help us weigh decisions, like if the space launch system is completed, what do we use it for? And it could possibly stimulate thinking in industry. Golly, is it possible there's a market for this alternative? I could give examples if you want. I'm fairly modest about this, but I noticed that there aren't a lot of comparable projects where people with a diversity of viewpoints are able to express themselves in a dynamic manner. So I have to believe in a number of different ways this adds to the existing activities of both industry-oriented, intellectually-oriented, movement-oriented space activity groups. I like to think that each respondent will wind up with more perspective on their own thinking processes. It's kind of a question you ask parallel to what's the value of fundamental, if not exactly pure, scientific research versus applied research where the exact goal is already decided. I think we're scoping out alternative goals and priorities in different ways, and that would be of value, but I'm not about to sell stock in a small company myself, telling you that we can make a profit out of this. I hope it advances our thinking because it includes your thinking.
Okay. Based on previous experience with your work in looking at the space community and the social aspects of the space community and other surveys, how many years does the data that you gain stay relatively current?
The rather large chapter that I wrote for the NASA book that's about to be public finds some relevance of poll data going back to 1947. And indeed, it looks at historical trends. I'll give you an example in a moment, but we're talking not just about the next Mars mission, but a wide range of possible goals where our priorities may go up and down over the years. Here's an example. The General Social Survey, every year or other year since 1973, has asked a question about whether funding for space exploration should be increased, kept the same, or reduced. Over the years, the percentages jump up and down. Well, that's maybe interesting. But for example, I compared it with funding for other programs in the General Social Survey, general science, defense budget, and during the period 1981 to 1991, when the possible military applications to space were being more emphasized than they were in preceding or subsequent periods, the correlation between space exploration funding and military funding went up in the general public, went up and then went down. And that's a general point. It could happen again. So while it is totally true that we expect and hope for progress, which means new opportunities, that some of the ideas guiding the space program, some of its best ideas go back half a century or more. So I think the data remain eternally relevant, even as we will need new data every once in a while in the coming years.
A couple of comments from me about this, as well as what the listener said. So today, meaning in early 2013, the country still faces lots and lots of economic issues, and lots of people are still, you know, on the margin with economic and personal problems, job problems, health problems, etc. And they still may be, you know, space enthusiasts or space people, or even working in the space community, and they still may feel their job is at risk. So how they might answer a question today in February 2013 about the funding for space or for NASA or its value for society might be really different had we had this survey in 2007 before all hell broke loose with the economy. So is there a way that you can is it worth factoring in the timing of a particular question? I don't even know if that's the right way to say it. Do you factor in, you know, the overall mood and situation and economy of the country when looking at, say, funding questions? Because that may very well influence how someone answers this, whereas in 2007, they might wanted to see $50 billion NASA budget. But now they need mortgage help or student loan help or, you know, whatever the crisis is that a family may be facing.
Well, I would like to hope that social scientists, including young ones who are just students now, will start adding at least short batteries of questions about space exploration to other surveys. As my example of the correlation with support for the military, back during, frankly, the Reagan presidential period. It's only one example. The general public showed that it wanted to increase, was more likely to want to increase NASA funding after the shuttle disasters. And so there can be a number of these factors. You mentioned the current economic situation, and in somewhat sophisticated public discussions, people are really making big distinctions between short-term, middle-term, and long-term investments. And that's an abstraction that can apply here as well. Indeed, and I don't know whether this will come out of this survey or other people could do subsequent things, should we be putting the emphasis on unmanned exploration through space probes, lander rovers, orbiting telescopes, or should we be putting it in what will the space launch system and the manned vehicles delivered into orbit with it be accomplishing, or should we be putting the money in really fundamental scientific and technological developments? You know, I was very appreciative of your mentioning that time I stood on the Florida beach in 1972, but something else happened in 1972, which was basically the cancellation of the reactor gas exhaust-based nuclear rocket program, which showed potential to be able to work as a rocket, but all kinds of environmental and other consequences. And there may be other technologies that are benign but more effective that we need to be working on. So I'm not saying that this is the right three set of options, let alone which ones we should do. But those options and people's conceptions of them will indeed change from year to year. The point is, please complete this questionnaire, but don't figure the job is done when you've filled it out and I've analyzed it. People really need to be looking at these things year in and year out.
Okay, so we're about to take our break, but let me run this by you, because you say, and I agree, our ideas and perceptions can change from year to year, but yet I know you are familiar, because I've read your work, where you have mentioned the old sin cons that Barbara Marks Hubbard and her group started. And I know Barbara and many, many of the people who participated in the sin cons have actually been guests on the Space Show, and I even used it in some classes in my teaching at North Dakota. And a lot of the ideas and perceptions that those SynCon groups and participants thought about in terms of space, its value to humanity, to the future of a better world, to all sorts of big picture ideas, that to me still remains very strongly in the space advocacy, space enthusiast, new space, commercial space world. In fact, if anything, those perceptions have gotten a lot stronger than the 70s when Barbara and the SynCon groups were going strong. I don't see those perceptions waning at all, even in the face of sequestration, horrible economic situation, space taking on more and more of a military role. Our military fights using space today, and that was not the case in the 1970s. So some of our attitudes get stronger and stronger even when facing adversarial external factors influencing, that could potentially influence that. We haven't lost our perception that space is extremely valuable and important for moving humanity forward in a peaceful world.
You want a response before we take a break?
Up to you if you want to hold
it. Well, if I may.
Go ahead.
As you know, in my doctoral dissertation and first book, there was a chapter on the Committee for the Future, as there were chapters on other social movement organizations. I had a great deal of respect for it. One of its fundamental principles was bringing people together, and indeed it was organized as a group meeting process where the participants would start out in task forces on different topics and then would come together. Now, I can't say how much that experience of going to two or three SynCon meetings at different times affected me, and I have to be cautious because I'm speaking from my own research here, not my NSF research. But anybody who looks up my publications and editing things will discover that I've been centrally involved in what's called the Converging Technologies activity. I did publish a book of my own called Nano Convergence. I only mention it not to sell the book, but to establish that I do that outside my NSF job, and I'm not just talking about NSF, where I've helped to organize quite a number of converging technologies conferences, at which there were often NASA people. The fundamental idea there is nanotechnology, biotechnology, information technology, and new technologies based in the cognitive sciences, perhaps wrapped up in social and economic dimensions that the social sciences, such as my own field, sociology, can contribute to. But look at the work in robotics that NASA often collaborates with other science agencies about, or issues of materials, whether they explicitly bring in nanotechnology or the broader range of exotic and new strong but light materials. The general notion that both people and fields need to come together to find common principles in harmony for the future in general, of which our place in the universe is a major part of it, strikes me as something that FinCon had 40 years ago and that is very, very widespread, including internationally today.
Absolutely. I see no matter what people think about this or that segment of space, this idea that space can bring people together and play a huge role in moving us forward is really solid and widespread. And so that isn't influenced by what our current day economic situation is, or who the president is, or what Congress is doing, or what rocket we're using. That just seems to be a foundation that to me, after nearly 12 years of the space show, is getting stronger and stronger. And I think, Doctor, that helps spread the word about the value and importance of space. And when people sign on to that big picture kind of idea and integrate it into their system, they might then start compartmentalizing as to, you know, whether robotics are better, or they want to do microgravity research for pharmaceuticals or space tourism or whatever it may be. But that overriding issue of bringing people together for good is really compelling, and I think space is one of the best examples of it. And as I've said, I think it gets stronger over time. It doesn't get weaker. So a very interesting an aspect of understanding the space community. And then one more comment about that is the average general public person that I get a chance to talk to does not have a sense of that. And if they get a sense of that, then they become committed to being interested and involved in the space community. But if they don't ever get a sense of the role that space plays in furthering us, bringing people together, it's much, much harder to bring them into a space-interested and concerned person. And that's kind of what I've found over nearly 12 years of doing the space show.
And indeed, the fact that you're doing something over internet, I published a book with Springer back in 2011 called The Virtual Future that was, this is specialized, and I don't say that every listener needs to be interested in this, but it was a study of 9 massively multiplayer online games that are about the future, 8 of them taking place in outer space. Now, of course, that's science fiction, but As curiosity and other human-connected robot vehicles explore the solar system, as you and I personally have essentially zero chance of physically getting to Mars, even if somebody does soon, using whether it's virtual reality, whether it's popular game versus serious science and education-oriented, using information technology to get our consciousness out into space, even long before our pathetic bodies get out there, 72, that's how I view mine, that's a convergence between information and communication technologies and space technologies. When I was at JPL during one of the Voyager 2 planetary encounters, there was a cartoon on the bulletin board that said, "Have you hugged your instrument today?" As in, have you hugged your children today,
right,
or whatever. And, of course, that instrument was hundreds of millions of miles away. But that sense of connection through knowledge, through the mind to the technology can be achieved much earlier through technological convergence than actually building resort hotels on Europa.
One last question, comment, and we'll take the break because you sparked something. The program I did on Monday was with Michael Lane, who has a company, and he wants to promote and push for a lunar space elevator. So I'm not really interested in the plausibility of that or not, or the markets. But one of the things he did is he used Kickstarter and was very, very successful in this new kind of funding, crowdsourced funding. And he went to various countries for additional support and ideas. And it appears that he's connecting up with a company in Iceland. I mean, most of us in the space community don't think of Iceland, that makes games. I think it's called CCI Games.
I will tell you all about that in a moment, but go ahead.
And they're really interested in working with Michael because in their futuristic outer space games, they want to incorporate the space elevator, but they don't know enough technically about it to make it realistic and plausible and technically correct in their game. So Michael is going to be working, as I understood him correctly, with CCI Games to make sure that their representation in these sci-fi games of the space elevator and the lunar elevator or a Mars elevator is absolutely correct, because these games are so widely spread, he believes it will put the correct impression and consciousness about a space elevator in the minds of thousands, if not millions, of gamers that would otherwise not even know that this exists because they're not part of the space community. They play sci-fi games that take place in space.
If you want to take your break, I have a big response to that.
Yeah, we'll take the break, and I just thought
that was a teaser. We'll come back in a few moments.
That's right. I just thought that was a fabulous broadening effort on the part of Michael and his Liftport group.
Absolutely, and I'll have something to add for it. Do it in a couple minutes.
Okay, listeners, back in 3 minutes. Please don't go anyplace.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, listeners. This is part two of our Friday Space Show program. Our guest today, Dr. William Bainbridge, we're talking about the very important space surveys that you can find on the blog and that will be in the summary that I write up when we archive this show. We urge all of you to do the surveys and to participate. Your ideas are very, very important. And where we left off just before the break was talking about computer games, sci-fi games taking place in outer space, and specifically CCI games out of Iceland and the incorporation of the space elevator concept in that game. And, Doctor, you said you were involved in playing that game, right?
One of my main research areas is massively multiplayer online games. I have a book published by MIT Press about World of Warcraft. My fifth book on the topic is about to come out from Oxford University Press. it's a way of looking at human-centered computing, and I certainly don't trivialize the space-related games or imagine that they are somehow realistic. But you happen to mention the Iceland group, and their game is more like a virtual outer space world. It's called EVE Online, EVE. They imagine sometime in the future that a wormhole allowed humanity to start colonizing a distant galaxy. And when the colonies were half established, the wormhole closed. And civilization fell on various different planets. And a few hundred years later, they redeveloped spaceflight, including interstellar flight. EVE Online is about 10 years old. It's so interesting because a tiny group of people in Reykjavik, Iceland, did it because they really cared and they wanted to innovate. It is really seen as very different from other things of its sort. You do not go down to the surface of the planets. You're mining asteroids. You're doing all kinds of things in orbit. Yes, there are a number of missions you perform to earn status in the game. But after you've learned how to do it, you and some friends take over an empty solar system and start building your own economy, and then perhaps having wars with the other ones. Now, some of the aspects of space flight are obviously unrealistic. Quick travel between solar systems is an obvious one. But the people who created it are really very serious about what they're doing. Let me give you a very remarkable, even bizarre example. In Benghazi, not only was the American ambassador killed, but so were three other men, including one named Sean Smith, who was an EVE player using the name Vile Rat. Well, that appears pretty bizarre and not related to serious stuff. But if you Google Vile Rat EVE, V-I-L-E space, R-A-T space, E-V-E, you will get this tremendous outpouring of affection for him after he was killed. And you will learn that in this virtual world, he played the role of a diplomat between the virtual communities. Thus, his real life was parallel to his virtual one. And it happened to be in outer space. Now, it's really inspirational. I hope that the EVE people will continue to include, as is possible, things that are educational, but they already include a lot that is very inspirational, as Sean Smith himself is inspirational. And even if the technology isn't exactly correct, a tremendous amount of your effort goes into assembling technology, to logically realizing what steps you have to go through to make something. So I see it as, well, they've got 400,000 subscribers. When I log in, it's typically 35,000 are online. They're all interacting with each other simultaneously. I'm not saying that this is the future of space in the virtual environment, but it is a recent component that could indeed become more realistic in corporate experiences that our space probes are having in our own solar system, for example.
Do you know if other gaming companies have picked up on this from the Iceland company? I mean, we don't associate Iceland with space policy or space anything, for that matter. Has this been picked up, or is it showing up in other computer games and virtual worlds?
There are other examples. It happens that, using the term broadly, Scandinavian countries have played a big role in this. is a somewhat sophisticated, now dozen-year-old space game called Anarchy Online from a Norwegian company. There is a very different kind of outer space virtual world called Entropia. Entropia Universe is one of its names, from a Swedish company. There was an American space-oriented game called Tabula Rasa. I don't know if that has rung a bell, but the creator of Tabula Rasa actually took my Tabula Rasa avatar with him up to the space program, the International Space Station. Unfortunately, his name is Richard Garriott. He's a top person in the game-creating community. He's the son of Owen Garriott, who was one of the Skylab astronauts. And Tabula Rasa was very much oriented toward promoting space exploration through a virtual environment. Unfortunately, the foreign-based game conglomerate that was managing it closed it down for its own business reasons while Garriott was on his way back in a Soyuz capsule from the International Space Station. And indeed, there was a lawsuit about that. Tabula Rasa is one of the most regretted shutdown massively multiplayer online games. Others may be coming along, but at the moment, the preeminent one is EVE Online.
Has NASA gotten involved or supported any games of this nature? Do they get involved in this, or the European Space Agency?
I've been trying to look into this myself. There's been a lot of talk about it. I know people who are exploring this possibility. I was unclear whether some of the things I've been supported in the news might have exaggerated the NASA connection, so I won't mention the particular things that I heard along those lines. There has, of course, been a long tradition of educationally oriented things. Buzz Aldrin was involved with a space-oriented computer game at one time. And, of course, the original, almost first computer game, Space War! Actually was a couple of on very, very old computers, a couple of simulated spaceships in orbit around a star in a fairly realistic gravity well where their orbits were actually fairly accurate. I have failed to land a lunar lander successfully at the Huntsville, Alabama Space Museum, so I guess I don't have a future comparable to Buzz Aldrin's. The educational potentials are very real, but I can't say that they're currently being exploited to the extent they could be.
This is an email question from Joe, who is in Phoenix, Arizona. And by the way, listeners, again, the toll-free number for those of you who can use it, 1-866-687-7223. And he says, regarding these simulation games and also movies like Star Wars, since they usually involve some sort of violence or intergalactic war or something like that, are they detrimental to the general population seeing space as a valuable pathway for our future, or does that not enter into it?
That's a good question, and I don't have a good empirically based response. You're, of course, aware of recent debates, which is a periodic debate, about whether violence in the game stimulates violence in reality. And, of course, on balance, it might either do that or it might be letting people blow off steam so they won't be violent in reality. Certainly, there is the real possibility, and science fiction has raised this problem all throughout the years, that a wider public will get an inaccurate and possibly negative picture of the possibilities in space through these kinds of popular culture. I mean, we certainly are treated to all kinds of things that violate the laws of physics in the movies and the games. I mean, the notion that Darth Vader's fighter rocket was powered by solar cells and had an ion engine but accelerated and turned like a fighter jet did not fit my notion of how the physics of ion engine rockets work.
I've done interviews with people who work at or who are the directors of various museums, including science fiction museums, and they say some of the biggest problems they face are from the younger school kids who come in, and they can't differentiate between reality and science fiction. And if they go to a NASA exhibit showing a video of a spacewalk or something, they get very, very bored because it can't compete with a scene from Star Wars or Star Trek or, from the science fiction world. And they have a very hard time differentiating between those events, and they think that the science fiction stuff is what should really be out there in space. And then they're disappointed, or they find it really hard to bridge the gap between the two. And the directors have told me that this is a really big problem with the younger kids that are still, you know, forming, you know, their understandings and their minds and stuff like that.
Well, this is quite possible. The question of whether this is true for many aspects of human life and whether the schools or the parents or others have to be careful that as the child gets older, they have access to increasingly sophisticated and accurate understandings of things, which would apply to the world of politics. I mean, is administering a city entirely about catching criminals, for example? So it's a general issue. I agree. And I should mention that, and I don't want to distract from the very serious and real space-oriented questionnaire that we're mostly focused on. If you take the preference data that Netflix has for movies, I tried this with 80 movies that depict human spaceflight. You know, not invaders from Mars, but humans flying through space. Those are preference data. How much do people like each of them? Tens or even hundreds of thousands of people rated some of the more popular movies. And if you look at correlations and use this well-established but frankly sophisticated thing called factor analysis to find the dimensions of variation, that indeed it does pull apart different kinds of science fiction movies that appeal to different audiences, including putting things like The Right Stuff and Apollo 13 in the same factor because they're about real space, and putting 2001 and Solaris in the same factor because they're about impossibly vast mystical possibilities, and putting together some of the more violent ones. So I agree this is a problem, but I'm also suggesting that the methods of social and psychological science can be used to understand it better, both as a problem, particularly for us who want to see space advance, but also as an intellectual question of what's meaningful to people. How do people put ideas together in their minds?
You have a caller waiting to talk to you. Good morning, caller. Who are you, please?
This is John in Atlanta.
Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I've been listening to this, and I was kind of started, you know, filling out your survey, and I'm kind of, I guess, a little stunned in a way at how my attitudes are so towards space are so much more pessimistic than they might have been, you know, 40 years ago or so, you know. I mean, I would have thought by now, you know, 40 years ago, I would have thought, you know, we probably have already been to Mars by now, you know. The preliminary moon base would have already existed, that something like a follow-on to the now-retired space shuttle would already be operating. And maybe my third generation, you know, and yet it's not there. And as I fill out this survey, I'm putting relatively pessimistic answers down. It just kind of stuns me a little bit.
I know the feeling.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, you know, it took an awfully long time from Columbus and the famous Pilgrim fathers and mothers to create the United States, let alone bring it to the point, whatever that is, that it's gotten to now. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of years. My own ancestors have been here forever, and yet so much of the progress has been during my lifetime or that of my grandparents. So it may be that as mortal human individuals, we're impatient. Recognizing that should not make us become lax. We should be enthusiastic. We should promote whatever we care about as individuals. I mean, I know I will never fly to Mars, but darn it, these rovers are doing better. They lasted a lot longer than I thought they would. And when I was twice at JPL, it was just such an honor to share that experience. They didn't know if the Voyager 2 would make it through Saturn's ring plane. And I can remember as we were getting back the pictures of the satellites of the planet Uranus. Look at that. Wow, that has been geologically transformed during its history. So it may be that, yes, I share your feeling exactly. But we are making progress, and with energy and intelligence together, maybe we can decide which steps deserve to be taken next, both for near-term and long-term progress.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just looked at, for instance, I understand about time frames, but there was like 66 years between the first heavier-than-air aircraft making its first flight and our landing on the moon. We're now 44 years later, and we couldn't get back to the moon within 5 years if we tried, I don't think, with a human craft. So, I mean, you know, we're kind of in a... I grant our unmanned probes, because of the robotic and electronic technologies have advanced rather rapidly, are doing awesome things. But I just wonder, you know, there seems to be such a lack of a fundamental exploratory spirit to really capitalize on what could be done, you know.
Well, you know, something that both Star Trek and the Kennedy administration gave us in whatever order of importance was the notion of space being a frontier. And when Van Ever Bush wrote the report in 1945 that led to the creation of the National Science Foundation, he called it Science, the Endless Frontier. And a century more ago, Frederick Jackson Turner was writing about the consequences for America of the closing of the frontier of the Wild West. So to me, not being pessimist or optimist, that space is so obviously a part of any future frontier we face, that if we let go, we're letting go of frontiers in general. And that would be a very, very big watershed in history. And I sense, despite your pessimism, that you're someone who doesn't want us to let go of that pioneer frontier discovering spirit.
I don't. No, absolutely not. I'm very much for it. I'm just... You know, we're working toward it, and it seems to me that every time somebody tries to do something to go forward, something else pushes back at least as hard as what we push forward sometimes. And it's, I guess it's just sort of that things have not really advanced, particularly like in propulsion technologies. I mean, we had
that
the ability
one, yeah.
to have nuclear thermal rocket technology by the mid-70s. it was in our grasp, we'd just let it go, you know, I mean, but didn't do it, you know.
Well, there are multiple technologies, and some of them are within our grasp. I know that on this program, often people discuss a very wide range of those, and I don't presume to know which ones are feasible. In my doctoral dissertation and first book, it was still plausible, this was pre-space shuttle, that the space shuttle would be totally reusable. So even though the chemical rocket engines are not particularly efficient, specific impulse or however you want to measure it, that if you weren't throwing part of the rocket away every time you flew, it might be affordable and economically efficient. Recently, there's been a lot of discussion, and from time to time, NASA and the Air Force do or do not cooperate. And one thing that sort of distressed me a few years ago was when, because of its other obligations, NASA was forced to back out of a collaboration on supersonic ramjet technology. So one can imagine a number of potentially very feasible technologies that allow one to get into Earth orbit at lower economic cost and hopefully high reliability and safety. And then once you're in orbit, I mean, there are at least two ways you can power an ion rocket engine, solar and nuclear. We know how that works. That does work. Whether there are more radical ways of getting up into orbit, I'm less clear. The original idea for the space shuttle was that both stages could be reflown and nothing would get thrown away during the launch. So a part of it is coming back to the general issue of what will our nation and the world invest in, short, middle, and long term. There is a sense that people are focusing very much on short-term problems now. Let us hope that through modest things like our own efforts, people will be ready to think long-term again after a little while.
Well, yeah, I understand. I mean, I'm advocating many of the things you're talking about, but I think the possibilities to do things are much greater than what's been achieved, and in that sense, it's been a more of a political, social issue, I guess, than anything else, is why a lot of this hasn't already occurred. Even I think, you know, for instance, some of the things are, you know, fundamentally technical, challenging. Others are just a matter of the will to do so, if you will, you know.
John, are you doing the 200-question version or the 300-question version or the droid version?
I guess this one here is a Word document. I think it's 300-question, isn't it?
Well, the two of them are Word documents. One is 300, and one of them is a shorter form at 200.
This one's 300. I'm in the middle. I'm just cranking along. I started
well, I appreciate
on,
it.
I listened to the show. About the first 30 or 40 questions and started going, boy, I'm just sounding pretty pessimistic here while I'm writing that.
But you know,
what I want to be saying. But,
be honest, express yourself, and I will really appreciate your contribution.
All right, thanks.
You know, the frontier and the pioneering aspect is alive and well. Not only is, for example, the Space Frontier Foundation and their New Space Conference totally promoting that, but the Space Foundation came out with their white paper on pioneering as the purpose for NASA in December of last year, 2012. And a lot of people, when they are asked why we should be doing humans in space or human spaceflight or all of, you know, going to other planets, they say because if we abandon exploring and pushing the frontier in time civilization dies. Do you have any information that validates that as a negative consequence of not pushing to develop frontiers?
I'm not about to express my pessimism about social science, but I did last year compare the issues of American Sociological Review from 2010 with 1970, and didn't see a lot of progress there. We sure know about past civilizations that stalled. Now, much of what has been written by social scientists about that is pretty old stuff and not currently integrated into social theory and methods. Arnold Toynbee, writing about challenge and response, about how if a group of people led by aware and energetic leadership responded effectively to a challenge, they could build a new civilization, and if they already had one, they could sustain it. A lot has been written about when civilizations fall, and the world's in a different situation now that we're all connected. But there is the worry that you're, to put it naively, you're either going forward or you're going backward. And there's so much I'm seeing by economists and other serious people that sometimes on the basis of empirical data are suggesting a declining rate of scientific discovery and technological innovation. I'm not 100% convinced, but the data seem to be tilting that way. And yet if we don't innovate, how do we resist this so-called economic race to the bottom, where the technically competent nation with the lowest salaries and the least favorable working conditions will clean all our clocks? And indeed, without innovation, how can we create the new industries that will provide jobs for people as other industries are closed down? So much in information technology today. So I think that without being absolutely certain, there's every reason to believe we have to keep innovating. This is one sector where we did innovate and see the potential for innovation. So it strikes me it would be exceedingly unwise, bordering on suicidal, not to continue forward.
do you have time for one more question?
Sure.
So this is Clark, and Clark is in Princeton, New Jersey, by email. And he says, David, at work, you know the drill. Here is my question. Is space to be considered as an investment in our future by those making policy rather than as a government expense? I understand that all money spent by the government is probably treated as an expense, but it seems to me if we're looking for innovation and leadership and going into our future, the money spent in those arenas, and space is a big one, should be considered an investment and therefore receiving a different prioritization from other aspects of spending in the national budget. Do you have any thoughts on that?
In the days when the space program was more active, there was clear bipartisan support for it. And if you looked at the voting patterns in Congress, yes, the people in Congress of the same party as the president were more likely to vote for NASA's budget. But if the party in the presidency switched, that switched. So I think your distinction about expense versus investment applies to a number of things that government does, some of the others of which are more politically controversial than space technology. So I would hope that there would be a widespread perception that it is an investment that benefits not just some groups in society or one political persuasion, but potentially all of us. While even as we're hoping that the politicians will find some way of coming together about everything, I would be somewhat optimistic that they're not going to be totally wrong in how they treat the area of space exploration.
Do you think if NASA told a better story, or the space community was able to tell a better story and connect better with segments of the general public, and I don't know what percentage of the general public one would have to connect with to make a difference, but this idea of cutting NASA and cutting space investments and equalizing it to all sorts of other things might be reversed. Does it depend on storytelling? And there is a new blog post, a two-series blog post by one of the better-known space people, Dennis Wingo, who is an aerospace engineer, who has looked at that recent NRC report about NASA's directions and has expanded space from a national perspective to include the commercial markets, to include the entrepreneurial segments, to include segments of space that are really driving things from around the world. I mean, people come to Silicon Valley, for example, and get involved in their own venture capital and entrepreneurial communities as a result of this. So space policy is really far broader than just NASA, yet the NRC report was charged with studying just NASA and its strategic direction. So might better storytelling help change this situation to broaden the view of space and what's important about it so that it doesn't take hits like other parts of the government?
Yes. To me, better storytelling is not only more compelling, but also honest. I'm not saying that it's dishonest. I don't want to just sell people on something because I personally care about it. And that's one reason why this questionnaire is seeking input from a lot of people. We'll get some insights on what things we should be communicating about. Now, there's so many other parts of this. We don't have time to talk about them today. I'll just sort of, as my final point, mention citizen science. There is a citizen science online project called Galaxy Zoo, in which ordinary citizens can participate in serious effort to classify galaxies based on photographs of them, some of which may have been taken from orbit. So I believe we need, just as your question was implying, not only better storytelling, but more stories from more perspectives about more different parts of it, involving more different segments of the population in something they care about. And through this questionnaire, I want to learn about what your listeners care about.
Listeners, we'll conclude here, but if you really do care about space, and many of us don't have money to invest in things, but we can invest our time in this questionnaire process. And I think you've gotten a glimpse over the last 90 minutes of why this information is so valuable for today, as well as taking us into the future on space with Dr. Bainbridge and his ability to analyze and to really go into this and relate back on what the community is doing, what it possibly should be doing, what some of our better stories are going to be about that we can relate to more people. So invest the time and do take the surveys. I mean, he'd like to get data in by March 1st, but that's not a drop-dead timeline. And talk it up with your friends. And if you're going to conferences or meetings or your email groups or you have a blog, take the information off the Space Show blog and put it on your blog so people will know how to get to the survey and how to take it and spread the word about it. This is one thing every single one of us in the space community can do that can make a difference. So I urge all of you to participate. Dr. Bainbridge, any concluding comments for us, or as I like to say, pearls of wisdom?
Oh, well, my thanks. It's really been great to be participating in this. I'll be downloading a number of your earlier programs. It seems like you're doing a great job here, a real communication center for the thousands and thousands of people who are seriously interested in space exploration. So thank you.
Thank you. And as I said earlier on, it's a real honor to meet you and to talk with you. I followed your work from way back when in your dissertation's work with the syncons. And it's just been a real honor to have a chance to talk to you. And when you have analysis for this, or if you want to come back on and talk some more about it, the microphone is all yours. I'm looking forward to hearing the follow-up and to staying on top of this survey and this situation.
Absolutely, and thank you.
Thank you. And listeners, that will be it for today. Dr. Bill Rowe is back with us on Sunday. He says he has new information on the cardiac and human factors of the Apollo lunar spacewalkers. Those of you who know Dr. Rowe from other programs know that he is a fascinating medical doctor with amazing theories that capture all of your attention, and I'm sure you will find the same on this coming Sunday with Dr. Rowe. Thank you all for listening. Special thanks to Dr. Bainbridge. And don't forget questions, comments on the blogs, or if you want to reach Dr. Bainbridge, send your notes to me and I'll be happy to forward them to him. And let's go out and tackle the survey and get it done. Everybody have a terrific weekend. Thank you again for being on the space show today.